It's Tuesday, January 5th, and in Georgia, it's still Election Day. We start here. With the U.S. Senate hanging in the balance, Georgia voters head to the polls.
You have that section of the Republican Party who feels that these state Republicans are sellouts.
Why everything you thought you knew about these races has been flipped upside down. Follow the drug maker's instructions, unless you're the British government.
They think on balance, it's much better to get one jab in the arms of as many people as possible.
With patients being rushed into hospitals, foreign officials are ignoring the whole two-shot thing for now. Are we about to follow their lead? And does the phrase, don't be evil, work in collective bargaining?
They're hoping to organize around ethical issues.
Silicon Valley might have just become a union shop. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
It's a new year, and tomorrow can be a new day for Atlanta, for Georgia, and for America.
There's a big difference between holding office and holding power. Joe Biden won the presidency on November 3rd. He will be sworn in as president. And with that, he'll likely undo a lot of Trump-era executive orders. He'll revert to a more traditional foreign policy. He'll take his departments in different directions. But getting legislation through Congress, that is power that lasts.
We'll put an end to the block in Washington on that $2,000 stimulus check. That money that will go out the door immediately. Tell people who are in real trouble.
And right now, Democrats have a chance for the trifecta. They've won the White House, they narrowly kept the House, and they're two seats away from controlling the Senate. Well, those two seats are both up for grabs in Georgia today.
It's time for ordinary folk to have somebody thinking about them.
All eyes in this country are in Georgia. We are going to save the country.
Health, jobs, and justice for all the people.
The choice in this race is between going to a socialist state that they're trying to describe and freedom.
One seat is currently held by Republican David Perdue. That seat was always going to be up for re-election in 2020. Then Georgia's other seat opened up. The governor appointed Republican Kelly Loeffler without an election. Well, she has to face one now. Neither won 50% of the vote in November, which means two seats on the line today. Let's get you primed for a day that will likely define how we talk about Joe Biden's first 2 years in office, whether he's dealing with a split Congress or a united one. We're joined by ABC Steve Osunsami, who's based in Atlanta. Steve, set us up here. Like, has it just remained campaign homestretch time for like the last 6 months or something? What has it been like leading up to today?
Insanity. I mean, it's nonstop. For most Americans, the intense cycle of the election ended a week after the November election. But for residents like myself here in Georgia, it has been exhausting.
Hey, y'all, this is John Ossoff.
This is Raphael Warnock.
I'm Kelly Loeffler.
I'm David Perdue.
You can't turn on a television, listen to the radio, watch the internet without seeing a political ad.
Senator David Perdue profited from the pandemic.
John Ossoff won't hold China accountable.
And then not just the attack ads. I have gotten probably a dozen cards, these sort of get out the vote cards, signed and mailed by voters in other states, Massachusetts, California, reminding me to vote, which I already have. It's just nonstop.
The road to socialism does not run through Georgia.
Can I ask you one more time? Are you ready to win this election?
And then you add to that all of the drama surrounding the president and his visits here.
Kelly fights for me. David fights for me. That I can tell you.
Right. And between that and like the campaign mailers you're getting from Massachusetts, it just speaks, I think, to how nationalized these elections have been. And again, so much of it about President Trump, right? He said the election was rigged. It wasn't. He said votes were miscounted. A series of recounts, even by hand, showed they weren't. He tried the case in like numerous courts. He lost. Well, then on Sunday night, Steve, we learned the president has been calling up the guy who runs elections in Georgia, essentially just telling him to find more votes. Is that actually going to have an impact on the voting, though, today?
Well, not only did he call up the Secretary of State and asked him to find more votes and was precise, in fact.
I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more that we have, because we won the state. So what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes.
Did you feel the pressure when he said, find the votes?
No, we have to follow the process, follow the law.
The fighting and drama over the election results in November have really split the Republican Party into pieces.
President Trump is not on the ballot in 2024 right now, so we'll just have to wait and see what would happen.
You've got some Republicans, including the Secretary of State here.
The Secretary wants me to make clear that everybody's vote is going to count. Everybody's vote did count.
And the governor and a few other elected officials, all Republicans, all Trump supporters, who stand by the election results, who insist that there was no fraud.
The president's legal team had the entire tape. They watched the entire tape and then, and from our point of view, intentionally misled the state Senate, voters, and the people of the United States about this.
Who commissioned investigations. They had investigations. They had the GBI, the state's top law enforcement officer, look into these allegations, and they found nothing credible.
Mm.
Plus the different court cases, all of this. I mean, it has been a zoo with manufactured claims that even Republicans have had to try to beat down somewhat unsuccessfully.
Do you think the president has been too critical on the governor?
Yeah. I think there is reason for his consternation.
My president, he win. And I say my president, he win. Okay? Biden did not win nothing.
And the president has been fanning those flames.
You know, I've had two elections. I won both of them. It's amazing. And
all of this sets you up for the runoff election that is happening today. You know, this idea that the elections can't be trusted, that the machines are changing votes, you know, that is factoring into the election today. There is great concern that a number of Republicans no longer trust the system and won't turn out to vote.
And a lot of Republicans are going to vote negative because they hate what you did to the president, okay? They hate it.
And we're already seeing what some may say are early signs of that. So when you look at the number of people who have voted before this morning, about 3 million voters in Georgia have voted in early voting. That's early voting and absentee voting. That number was about 3.9 million in November at this same time.
Mm.
But when you look closely at the numbers, you'll notice that there is more turnout in the bluer counties and less turnout in the early vote in the red counties. So some of this drama appears to be having an impact on the vote in this runoff.
Right. That was going to be my question, Steve. In a normal year, I would say, like, fine, Democrats are polling well. It's about even. Like, no one quite knows what's going to. But, like, Democrats don't show up for these special elections in the past the way Republicans do. So if you're polling even, congratulations, but you're probably going to lose, right? Especially this year, you'd think when Republicans have all these things going for them. Like, the average voter is thinking, do I really want to give Democrats all the power in Washington? That's a powerful thing. So at the end of the day, maybe Republicans aren't thrilled with what's going on. They might disagree with each other, but, like, don't they still have, you know, a built-in advantage of some sort?
No, not necessarily. But I mean, you know, and you're right. If you had asked me 6 months ago whether a Democrat had a chance in a runoff election in Georgia, I would say the answer is absolutely not. I'd bet the farm on it because Democrats just don't do well in runoff elections, much less statewide elections in Georgia. But everything has changed. The script has been flipped.
You voted in record numbers in November. Your voices were heard. Your votes were counted. The will of the people prevailed. We won three times here.
First, Biden winning election here, which has galvanized and encouraged Democrats to actually believe that they can truly win. And then secondly, what's happening on the right, all of this drama over the election and whether it was fair and whether it was legal and whether illegal people voted or dead people voted, all of these made up things, they've all had an impact and they all lead to where we are today. Like you said, you know, the polls are showing that it's really a tie. And for Democrats, that's a victory, you know, in and of itself. But, you know, it's entirely possible the Democrats could win. I say possible. and that is something that I think has many people on the right quite concerned, because that normally isn't possible in a runoff election. And I will say this, one positive sign is that Senator David Perdue has already come out saying that he is confident in the security of this election. Now, whether he will still say that if he loses, you know, is anyone's guess. But currently, you know, he is siding with state Republicans who are saying that, you know what, we've got this. And
which is another reason, Steve, perhaps that Republicans are like, hey, if I like the president, you're not backing up the president. What are you doing? I'm not voting for you.
Oh, yeah. That's a big part of this.
We're not happy with the way our governor, secretary of state, and we don't know what are these two senators going to be like. We're going to give them our vote, but we're biting our tongue.
You have that section of the Republican Party who feels that these state Republicans are sellouts, that they haven't done enough.
I'll be here in about a year and a half campaigning against you, Governor, I guarantee you that.
And what the state leaders, all Republicans and Trump supporters, are saying is we're just doing our jobs.
This would be difficult if I didn't feel like when I went to bed every night I was doing the right thing. This would be very difficult.
The lieutenant governor who I talked with, he said something really powerful, which is that, you know, he has to go home to his sons. I think he said has three sons, and look them in the face and be able to say that he did what was right and what was legal. And he can't do that by trying to overturn the election.
Fascinating moment, fascinating day. Steve Osunsami, we'll let you get to it. Thanks so much.
Yep, you're welcome.
Next up on Start Here, some very careful vaccine plans are getting chucked out the window. Back in a bit. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/starthere today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/starthere.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
I just received my second dose of the Pfizer vaccine, and so I'm really excited because that means I'm just that much closer to having that immunity.
Yesterday in Texas, we saw several healthcare professionals happily lining up for their vaccine. The difference between them and most of the other people getting it yesterday was this was their second dose, as in the final step to being truly vaccinated against COVID-19. But the problem is, a lot of Americans are stuck waiting in line for their first dose.
That has not been going as quickly as we would have liked.
At the national level, vaccines are being bought, they're being procured, they're being shipped, but state and local bureaucracies are just being caught flat-footed. Add to that the fact that this virus is actually flying around faster than ever. Literally.
This morning, the TSA reporting nearly 2 million people took to the skies Friday and Saturday, more than 14 million over the past 2 weeks. despite CDC warnings not to travel or gather in large groups.
Tonight, the news coming in that highly contagious variant of COVID already here in the U.S., at least four states now, that variant first seen in the U.K., and news coming in just tonight of an emergency lockdown there.
The U.S. is not the only country experiencing these problems, and everyone's reacting very differently. In fact, last night, the U.K. announced it is going on full lockdown mode and will be there for weeks. Remember, they started vaccinating people a few days before we did. Let's go to ABC senior foreign correspondent Ian Pannell in London. Ian, what freaked out British officials so much here?
Yeah, I mean, this is back to the future, Brad. This feels like the announcements that were made last spring.
As I speak to you tonight, our hospitals are under more pressure from COVID than at any time since the start of the pandemic.
What sparked it really was the rate at which the caseload is growing. So there are more people in hospitals across the UK today with COVID-19 than there were in the first wave, and that has officials worried.
And there's no doubt that in fighting the old variant of the virus, our collective efforts were working and would have continued to work. But we now have a new variant of the virus, and it's been both frustrating and alarming to see the speed with which the new variant is spreading.
You know, Britain's had a number of lockdowns, and they have all pretty much worked at the time. This latest one, the restrictions that were put in place didn't seem to be kicking in. The numbers of people in hospitals just continue to grow exponentially. So the UK has a whole series of, this has nothing to do with the tier levels of restrictions, but the risk level. Think of like a national security risk level. It goes from 1 to 5. It moved up to 5 yesterday for the first time ever.
We must therefore go into a national lockdown, which is tough enough to contain this variant.
And therefore, they've decided to introduce this new national lockdown again.
That means the government is once again instructing you to stay at home. You may only leave home for limited reasons permitted in law.
You can only leave your house for essential shopping. You can only go to work if it's absolutely essential and you cannot work from home. You can go out and exercise. You're encouraged to do so only once a day.
Yeah, I just think it's just all a bit quick.
I'm not comfortable at all. I think I'm more terrified now than I have been since March.
So I think we're going to see pretty similar scenes to those that we saw last spring.
But the difference here, Ian, is there is a vaccine now. That's the difference between now and March. The question is just whether people can get it. So right now, these vaccines so far require 2 doses. Yesterday, I asked Ann Flaherty if American doctors would consider just, you know, administering the first dose to lots and lots of people. Everyone, come get your first dose. Even if that means that people might not get that second dose on time, on the recommended timeline, it sounds like Britain is starting to do exactly that. Just hand out the first dose and worry about the second one later.
Yep, that's exactly what's going to happen. So people who had a second appointment scheduled have now been told that that is going to be delayed. It's not going to be delayed indefinitely, but it will be delayed. And the new plan, and again, Boris Johnson was promising that everybody over 70, everybody who's vulnerable for health reasons, will have a vaccine. He wasn't clear whether it's one shot or two, and I think he only means one, sometime in February.
And they say that the data actually supports that. They say that operationally, it's recommended that the second dose of both vaccines, therefore, should be routinely scheduled between 4 and 12 weeks after the first dose.
Pfizer have said they have no evidence that you can delay things beyond, say, 20 days, and that is the tension at the moment here in the UK.
That's my question, Ian. Like, is this safe to tell people, yeah, we're just going to wait 7 or 8 weeks?
Are you taking this decision for political reasons? Now, the government, of course, every government takes decisions for political reasons, but the government has a very senior medical advisory board, appropriately enough known as SAGE. And they have also agreed with this decision that they think on balance, it's much better to get one jab in the arms of as many people as possible who are in that vulnerable group, the people who are sadly dying, filling up those ICU wards every single day, than waiting and keeping people unprotected while the first person gets that second jab.
If different data is generated supporting different dosing or dosing schedules, then and the FDA approves it according to gold standard, then that's what we're going to do. But we're going to stick with the data that we've got.
So, yes, it's a risk, but we now hear other countries are thinking about the same thing. It's a huge gamble, but we're also in the middle of a pandemic, something none of us have ever witnessed. So maybe it is time to take that kind of calculated risk.
Yeah, and with a promise from these vaccine companies that more doses are on the way, but it's up to these countries to actually roll them out. And so far, that has been the problem. And that is what you don't want happening, is waiting for months for those second shipments. Ian Pannell in a even more locked down UK than it was yesterday. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Brad.
Over the years, the tech world has smashed through lots of firsts, lots of controversies. Well, yesterday, employees of Google announced they had formed that giant company's first union for tech workers. So what does it mean for tech? And what does it mean for workers in America, where more and more of our jobs are tech jobs? Lauren Cowrie-Gurley is a staff writer for Motherboard at Vice, where she covers tech and labor issues. Lauren, what happened here?
Yeah, so yesterday morning, 227 workers at Google, and this is both employees and contractors, of which there are 120,000 in the world. So this is only 220-something of them, announced that they had launched a union that they're calling Alphabet Workers Union. Alphabet is Google's parent company.
Let's start with that bombshell Google lawsuit accusing the company of encouraging employees to spy on each other and silencing complaints.
Breaking news, hundreds of Google engineers and other workers are walking off the job. They are protesting the internet company's treatment of executives accused of sexual misconduct.
And this has been riding and building for years. There's been a lot of activism and protests since 2018 at Google.
Time's up, and this is the best way that we can do that.
Organizers of Thursday's walkout claim a culture of complicity and dismissiveness at Google.
Google has been leading sort of a worker revolt within Silicon Valley.
For every story in the New York Times, there are thousands more at every level of the company, and many have not been told.
And so this was sort of the logical next step. People expected that at some point Google workers were, you know, going to form a union. And so that's what they've done now. And they're hoping, you know, this isn't a traditional union for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that they're hoping to organize around ethical issues.
Yeah. Well, and explain that to me, because this is the other question I wanted to ask you. Is this a union? Because like organizers call it a union, fine. But like there are pretty specific rules in this country about what makes it an official union. Are the Alphabet workers there yet?
Right. So it is a union. It has not been recognized by Google, and there hasn't been a formal like union vote or election of anything of that sort. But legally, these workers, although they're not recognized by Google and they don't have a contract, meaning there aren't rules that Google has to follow, they do have rights. And those rights are outlined by the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which gives workers at any company, as long as they're employees, the right to organize to improve their working conditions and to protest collectively if they want to change things.
So like the average person can kind of deduce why someone like in a factory town would want protections, right? Like there's one gig in town, it's down at the plant. If you get hurt on the job, like there goes your career. And there's one boss who can like just keep pushing the wages down. Google employees, that is not them, right? Like these are some of the most sought after employees in the world, right? Like they're at the top of their game. Why do they need to have collective bargaining for their white collar employer?
Yeah, I think there is definitely a common conception that the only type of worker that needs a union is one who's being, you know, exploited or who's underpaid, exploited in like a serious sense of, you know, maybe it risks, you know, having an arm or leg chopped off at work and is making very little money. Right. What Google workers will argue, and a lot of workers who are part of like sort of the new wave of tech worker organizing will argue, is that that's not the only reason why workers would need a union.
I don't want to just be text in a box. I don't want to be a little circle with my face with my badge photo in it. I want to be a flesh and blood person saying these things. And that's really important to me because it's right at the heart of why I'm deciding to leave the company in the middle of a pandemic. Because I don't think Facebook is paying enough attention to the raw human needs of the people who use our platform.
Workers also need a union just to have a voice at work. And as Google and Amazon and Microsoft and other tech companies, Uber, Lyft, other tech companies gain more and more power over, you know, the daily lives, not just of their employees, but over so many aspects of the entire world, employees are feeling like they have very little say in, you know, the types of technologies that they're engineering.
Google, its workers in open revolt, demanding that Google stop working on military contracts.
Sometimes they don't even know what projects they're working on, whether it's used, you know, to build weapons for the military or to cage or help, you know, track down immigrants who are crossing the border.
Some GitHub contributors, as you mentioned, more than 100 of them signed an open letter to Microsoft. Their threat here is clear cut. Either Nadella ends his relationship with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or they will take their projects elsewhere.
Say. Or whether it's being, you know, implemented by the, you know, oil and gas companies to drill in the ocean. And so right now, they don't have a traditional union with a contract, but what they do have is they have a union that can use its leverage by, you know, being sort of a collective of many people within the company that can pressure Google to sit down and that can also have the protection of this body, and so that individual workers aren't being retaliated against or targeted by the company. There's more protection with the union behind them.
And a huge win for Kickstarter employees after its union reached a deal in their favor.
And so it's sort of really an experiment in some ways, because this union without a contract thing hasn't really been done much before. But if it goes well, I think you could definitely see Amazon, Microsoft, other workers sort of copying this model.
Yeah, it's not just about like free lunches at the really cool cafe anymore. That's not what these employees are about. In the meantime, Google tells ABC News, quote, "We always worked hard to create a supportive and rewarding workplace for our workforce. Of course, our employees have protected labor rights that we support, but as we've always done, we'll continue engaging directly with all of our employees." Not really a ringing endorsement of this union. Lauren Cowrie-Gurley from Vice. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And one last thing. For sports fans, there was one clear, shining moment when the novel coronavirus went from a curiosity to a game changer.
The NCAA has made the decision to cancel the men's and women's tournament.
And the NCAA has no other choice but to be a responsible global citizen here.
For the first time in 80 years, the NCAA announced it would not be able to crown a champion to its college basketball season. The organization lost more than $300 million. Well, guess what? We're a year later and the pandemic is worse than ever. But rather than forgo March Madness again, yesterday officials announced they will try to do what the NBA did, have its playoff tournament in a bubble. Just one problem, the NBA invited 22 teams to play for up to 3 months. The NCAA plans to have 68 teams all playing within a couple days of each other.
Yes, the NBA played in a bubble in Orlando. This is even bigger than that. And this is going to involve multiple areas around Indianapolis.
The new plan is to not do it all at one gym, but to play all the games near Indianapolis. You got college gyms, an NBA arena, even two courts in the Pro Football Stadium used by the Colts. And if you were getting excited, no, only one game will be played there at a time. But it begs the question, can you even call this a bubble?
NCAA officials said that they'll need more than 2,500 rooms to house all of the teams. They'll put them on separate floors in different hotels. The hotels will be connected.
Players will be on dedicated floors of hotels, but their family members will be allowed to attend games. They'll be traveling from city to city every couple days. And where are they going to practice? There's currently a huge convention center listed as their practice facility, but does that mean what, dozens of teams are going to share one building? Or will they all spread out to their own building, each with their own janitorial staffs and security guards? Just a ton of people moving around. The even bigger concern, though, is not in March. It's how we get to March.
Duke's basketball game scheduled for today now postponed as the ACC makes that announcement overnight. That followed the positive test within the Florida State program.
Whatever you think of this theoretical bubble, there is no bubble right now. Teams are currently crisscrossing states to play, and many of them have already sustained outbreaks in their locker rooms.
To no one's surprise, the overall number one seed is Duke.
Every year, there are teams who almost got into the big dance, but didn't. This year, teams could still be there waiting for a call the night before the tourney begins, telling them, "You were on the bubble. Well, now we need you inside of it." going to be like alternate jurors, but for NCAA teams. Indiana is going to be something because divisions 2 and 3 are also going to have their own bubble tournaments in different cities in the state. Women are going to be doing the same thing in San Antonio. It's going to be a wild month. For live coverage of the Georgia runoff tonight, you can head to abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.